Last night when we were, I had finished my last look at this chapter in preparation for the sermon. We decided to go out to dinner because I didn't want to cook in that hot kitchen. And when we got into the car, it was 109 degrees outside. And by the time we drove from San Carlos to Redwood City, it was 113 in the car. So all of you who are in here today, you're faithful and true. And we respect you for being here because we know it's been a very, very hot. It's been a very, very hot week. Usually when we have hot weeks like this, the activity that my family will engage in is we have a boat. And so we'll spend our time out on the lake, up at Lake Tahoe. And my kids will spend their time. I have a 24-year-old son and a 21-year-old son. And their big joy is to go wakeboarding. And when we're wakeboarding, of course, the whole object of going wakeboarding is to see who's the best and the brightest at wakeboarding. It's a big competition. So my sons will say, you know, compare themselves. Who went the farthest? Who jumped over the wake the farthest? Who was the highest? Who did the best trick? And so their dad and I are supposed to be on the back of the boat saying, oh, that was so great. You did all that. You know, and we're still doing it at 24 and 21. And we really started this off when they were like 2 and 3, but it's our greatest joy and pleasure. The reason that my boys want to do that and why most of us want to do that is because we really want to be seen and appreciated for who we are. It's a driving desire of the human heart. Every little child seeks out that kind of approval from a parent. They want them to see them do their best stuff. And I remember when I was little, I used to sit up on the parallel bars. I was real athletic when I was little. Kind of my family takes, all of us are athletic in my family. But I used to like hang from the parallel bars, and after I ate my spinach, I thought I was exceptionally strong because my mom told me I was. So when I was hanging from the bars, I'd say, watch me, mommy. I'm really, really stronger. I can see what you mean. So I really wanted her to see what was really good about me and to appreciate it. That's a desire we have because we're made in the image of God. And in the image of God, we're supposed to reflect something of God to this world. And we know that. It's a powerful force within us. But to not be seen and appreciated for who we are is as crushing to the human heart as it is to be appreciated for it. For many in our world today, and we can certainly read about it on the news today, the color of their skin or their gender or their educational level, their appearance has prevented them from being seen and appreciated for who they are. And that's really painful. I read a book this this past year that I've shared with my small group of women that I teach on Thursdays called Left to Tell. And it's about a Rwandan woman who was a college student and came from a loving and wonderful family in which she was nurtured and cared for, and they worshiped God. And she got to college, and a civil war broke out in their country. And all of a sudden, this woman was only seen as a Tutsi, and Tutsis were to be destroyed. So the Hutu tribe came and killed all the Tutsis. And this woman was caught in the middle of all of this, trying to comprehend how it's possible that all of a sudden she became nothing just because they saw her as a Tutsi. In a more contemporary illustration of this, when I was preparing for this, there was a boy on the radio, and he was 12, and he called into the Dr. Laura show. And he called in with this really sad little story. He said, I want to know how I can get my dad to pay attention to me. He said, my dad and my mom are divorced, and I only see my dad twice a month. But he really doesn't want to spend time with me. He just works the whole time I'm there, and he seems bothered that I exist. That's really a common thing that happens a lot in our culture, and a lot of hurting kids are not being seen for who they are because of it. So I wanted to take this story, I wanted to illustrate this morning and say, our hearts don't change. This story is 4,000 years old, and it's about a slave woman in Egypt, but it has great applicability to us today. The human desire to be really seen from the inside is something that we're all born with. In 1 Samuel 16:7, it's one of my favorite verses. It says, God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Thank goodness for that. We do have someone who can see us, the real us. Hagar's encounter tells us who he is. So who is this Hagar that I'm talking about here? Well, Hagar's an Egyptian by nationality, a slave of Abraham and Sarah, who are Hebrews. her story is really caught up in theirs, and it's one of the reasons why it's so little told. Abraham and Sarah, as you might know, Abraham's the father of faith, and so his story is told for a long time, and in the New Testament, he's known as a friend of God and the great, great man of faith. But during the man of faith's journey on earth, he had times when he was a faithful giant, and he had times when he had feet of clay. And so part of the feet of clay times are how he acquired Hagar, and we're going to read about some of those today. But what happened to Abraham was, when he was 75 years old and Sarah was 65, God called Abram to leave his family and his home and follow God into a new land that he'd give him. And God promised him that all the families of the earth would be blessed through him. So Abram followed God's words and went to the land of Canaan, which God was going to give him. But the paths to God's promises are not always easy. There were Canaanites on the land they would have to overcome. And Sarai, his wife, was barren. We learned that from Genesis 11. So how is God going to bless all the families of the earth through Abram when he has a barren wife? That's kind of the question. And all good stories have some sort of conflict and a resolution which is working through. So what we're working through in this Abraham story is, how is God going to overcome this obstacle? It was during a trip when they were in Canaan, there was a big famine in Canaan, that they traveled down to Egypt, which is a breadbasket of that time. And during that time, when they went down to Egypt, Abraham had a little bit of failing faith. And during that episode there, Pharaoh ended up giving him oxen and sheep and slaves and male and female donkeys. Not because he had a lapse of faith, but because he had sold his wife, his beautiful wife Sarai, into Pharaoh's household as a wife. He was trying to protect himself. In those days, in ancient times, if you liked a pretty woman, you just took her if you were the Pharaoh. So Abraham got afraid, and Sarai ended up in the household of Pharaoh, and God had to send plagues and get Abraham out of that mess. So Hagar starts off in the story actually as an insertion of a lapsed faith in Abraham's part. So what happened to Abraham is God came and gave him another promise. He said, after he'd gotten back to the land of Canaan, I'm going to give you a son, and through your son, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And Abraham, at that point, was pretty darn old, and he didn't know how it was going to happen. 10 years later, when Abraham was 85 years old, and Sarah was 75 years old, and time is ticking, the promise still hadn't been completed. So Sarah decided she had to do something about it. So I call it Sarah's plan to accomplish God's ends, and that's where we begin our story for this morning. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "Go, behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of his wife. Now, if I'd waited 10 years after I got a promise and I was 75 years old and I was Sarai, I might think that that was a good kind of human way to accomplish God's ends. It makes a lot of sense. But there's some hints in the language of this passage in the beginning that tell you this might not be such a really good idea. The first thing Sarah does is she looks and it says she has a problem, barrenness, and she had an Egyptian maid. That language of possession continues throughout this entire encounter. Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai, never say Hagar's name. They always call her maid, maidservant. She's talked as a possession. So the first hint is that they don't see who she really is. They just see her for what she can do for them. Now, the problem comes out of that, of course, is Hagar is a human being, and she doesn't go along with just being a pawn in this situation. So she acts like a woman, and that's a big problem for Sarai. Then, the second hint that there's a problem going on here is that you can see that Sarai recognizes that the Lord is the one that's keeping her from having children, but she doesn't ask him any questions. She doesn't ask him about it or talk to him about it in this passage at all. I'm sure she has at other times, but in here she doesn't. So she just acts without the Lord's help. And the third hint that maybe there's an issue here is in verse 3, it says, Abram listened to the voice of his wife. In the NIV Bible, it says he agreed with his wife. But listen to the voice of the wife is a clearer translation from the Hebrew. That phrase, for anyone who knows the story of Genesis chapter 3, is the words that Adam used when he took the forbidden fruit from Eve, and he ate, and he fell. Now, for all of you guys in here are saying, I know, I should never listen to my wife and my, I know that those women shouldn't be listened to or talked about. I want to make sure you understand something. The problem here is that he listened to a human being's voice versus God's voice, not that it was a woman's voice versus a man's voice. And the same thing's happening here. Both of these people are people of faith. Both of these could have asked God, but neither one of them did ask God. Abram listened to Sarai. Sarai listened to her pain and her humanness to come up with the decision, and neither one of them consulted God. And that's what caused kind of a lot of problems here in this narrative. So going ahead with that, I could have looked at it, didn't listen to the voice of his wife, didn't listen to God, listened to the voice of his wife. And so then what I want to think, what causes that and how can we apply that to our lives? Because I certainly do it all a lot. I'll go around and have a problem, and I'm going to call my friends lots. Or lately I've discovered that email is a great way of getting the message across, so I can put out an all-points bulletin on my email asking for help. Now, it's not bad to ask human beings for help, but why do we go there first and not second? Why is it so much easier to go to your friends than it is to go to God first and ask him what his plan is for you? Well, I think one of the reasons is we're in so much pain, and Sarah's in so much pain here, that she just wants to be heard, she wants to be seen, and she wants to have a solution to it. And isn't it true that our pain is what drives so many of the things that we are tempted to do to sin, to make the pain go away and to make ourselves feel better? Sometimes we desire something so much, and the pain of not having that is so great that we go ahead and do it anyway, and we become vulnerable to sin. I see it a lot when there's relationships involved, and there'll be a relationship that you might fall into because you hunger so much for a relationship that even a bad relationship will look better to you than no relationship at all. And the loneliness drives you to meet your need apart from God. Sometimes when I'm depressed or I'm like totally stressed, what I like to do is to alleviate my loss or my depression or whatever it is, my anxiety is, I like to go shopping and I like to go down and buy something. And I had up here a Macy's bottle, which was evidence that I was shopping yesterday. And it was really nice and cool in the stores. But I was shopping really to make myself feel better. I was kind of stressed about doing this. I thought, I need a break. I'm going to go shopping. That's what I do. Some other of us might eat too much. We might drink too much. We might buy too many big-ticket items. I don't know if you're a big-ticket item person. You might be one of those people that meets your relational needs with going to the computer and spending all day on the computer and not reaching out to a human being. So we all do some things to make ourselves better. We are tempted to alleviate our relational pain with people, things, and quick fixes when what we need is God. Meeting our deepest needs with quick fixes often causes us, in our lives, unpleasant circumstances, and in some cases, even disastrous ones. And so this is true for everybody that was in this passage of Scripture for this morning. So the unforeseen consequences of acting on our own, of acting on our plan, went like this. And when she saw, that is Hagar, that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. That word despised means made light of. She had hoped that having a child would build her up. But what happened actually is it's brought her down. And Sarai said to Abram, may the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid in your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. But Abram said to Sarai, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. And so Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. No one comes out well in this passage. It reminds me of that verse from Romans that said, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Sarah's plan that she hoped would build her up has brought her low. And she blames Abraham, which is really kind of funny because it wasn't even his idea. So she turns around and blames him for no reason that I can think of other than his passivity. Hagar rose from maid to wife, and now because of her pride has been made a maid. And in chapter 21, the word used for her is slave. So she has been demoted hugely in a very short period of time. And Abram, where is he anyway? He passively seems to go along with whatever Sarai comes up with for a plan. And then when it goes awry, he washes his hands of the whole thing. And he won't defend Hagar before this really, really angry woman. So all of them are not looking too good in this episode. Well, this is kind of a sordid story in the Bible, I think, isn't it? We kind of make these stories sound kind of child-friendly, but in many ways, this story about surrogacy and two wives, and everything is kind of sorted. But I was going to say, I'm so thankful that these stories are recorded in the Bible, because if all the people that were held up as faith giants were perfect in every way, and when they weren't real people, then there wouldn't be any hope for me, because I can sure look around at myself and go, I have faith, but I am no faith giant. I have feet of clay. Sometimes I believe. Sometimes I go to Nordstrom. Sometimes I believe. And sometimes I do the same thing that Sarai did. I have a great idea, and then I try to fulfill it, and then I yell at my husband when it doesn't happen. I just did it to him this week, as a matter of fact, in preparation of this study. So Kim says, yes, you did. Even Ginger Hall told him, boy, were you in trouble at the beginning of this week. But I'll explain that. When my husband decided that he needed a horse, it was my time to decide that I needed to tear out the backyard. Now, the reason being is if we have a horse, he'll never tear out the backyard, which needs to be replaced and done. So, as I'm preparing for this study, what happens? I go, he has now decided to put the yard back together on Monday when I'm preparing for this lesson. So I have workers in my house and construction stuff going on, and I was not saying good things about Kim. So I was blaming my husband for the very thing I was asking him to do. It's totally irrational. Anyway, Bible characters are like us. That's the point. They have feet of clay. They have feet of clay. And so why does God reveal that to us? Why does he tell us about this? Well, he tells us because we're like that. And he tells us because he wants us to know that it's not them that saves themselves. It's he that saves them. It's not because you're good that you're in this church this morning, coming to church and worship services. It's because he is good and you're responding to his goodness. He lets us see their lives fully exposed so that we will know it's not our goodness but God's goodness, that nothing we can do is too much for him to overcome. I love stories of extremities like this one because God can overcome them. So if he can overcome this, then he can overcome any of the things that happen in our life. Well, so Hagar, poor Hagar, she's now pregnant, and she's been used and thrown away from this scene with Sarai and Abram. Abram won't defend her. Sarai is furious, and so she does the only thing she can think of. She runs away. And she runs so far that when we find her here, she's on the southern border of Canaan, on the edge of Egypt. This is really far. She is exhausted. She has come a long way. She really intended to get away. But what happens to her is something wonderful happens to Hagar when she is just sitting there by the well in the desert. She said she discovered that she's not alone. She wasn't alone in that desert under the baking sun because it says she was found by the angel of the Lord. So she was lost and now she's found. So it says, now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. This is who God is. God is the one who comes and meets us in our extremities, and he meets her in her most desperate time. So I'm looking at it and thinking, well, who's the angel of the Lord? Not too many of us have had a visitation by the angel of the Lord. Well, he's not an angel like wings. When we were trying to get visual overheads for this project, all we could find were angels that were white and flowing and had white flowing garments, and that's not what this is. He's a messenger. He's a messenger of God, but he's not a angel of the... He's not one of the... an angel of the Lord. He's the angel of the Lord. He's the angel that particularly is close to God. And it's been defined in many different ways, but I think this is the definition that I like the best. There was a scholar named Hamilton who gave me this definition. He said, he is the visible manifestation, either in human or fiery form, of God. He appeared to Moses in the burning bush. He appears 58 times in the Old Testament. In all of those times, he acts much more as a representation of God than a representative of God. So he comes and brings a message, but it is God who Hagar recognizes has brought her the message. So God has made a visitation to Hagar. He's mentioned four times in this encounter, and the reason that it's repeated four times is because in the first part of this text, it was Sarah, 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 all her idea. Now it's angel, angel, angel. It's God, 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 all his idea. By the fourth time, it takes her that long to recognize that he's God. But if I were in the desert, I would think I was hallucinating or I was having a mirage, so she needed that much time. But the coolest thing that the angel does for her is he tells her why he's here. He's found her. He's been looking for her. In the Hebrew, the word for found here is a word that means found by search. He didn't randomly happen by her as he was wandering the desert. He'd been out looking for Hagar. He knew she was lost even if she didn't. When she's sitting by a spring, that's a picture in Scripture of life-giving refreshment. It can be figuratively thought of as life. And in the New Testament, John uses it a lot for the Holy Spirit is the living water. So it's a picture of God giving, life-giving, sustaining life. And God, its presence is there. So he gives her this message of hope in the middle of her most extreme times. But the coolest thing that God does is that he says to her, Hagar, he calls her by name. Where have you come from and where are you going? This is the only person, God is the only one in this passage who calls Hagar by name. Everybody else sees her as a maid or a servant or something else that they can use. But God knows who she is. And he asks her a question. And you know, why did Jesus ask so many questions? When you're in the New Testament, Jesus asked questions all the time. And one of the things I learned from studying that is it seemed like he was looking for a response. He was trying to engage the person he was talking to. And if he found that the heart was receptive to him, he told more. If he found that the heart was not receptive to him and the person was closed-hearted, he would often tell a parable or he'd give them a riddle or something else because they weren't open. I think he's asking Hagar to respond to him. And I think he's finding that her heart is good and honest because she answers him completely honest. She's running away from she's a slave, which is not a good thing to be a runaway slave. She's a slave and she's running away, but she doesn't know where she's going. Well, so then the angel tells her something that's really quite a promise. He says, the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so there will be too many to count. And the angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child and you will bear a son and you shall call his name Ishmael because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And he'll be a wild donkey of a man and his hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand will be against him and he will live to the east of all of his brothers. So he gives her a command that I want to spend the most time with. The command is return and submit. I imagine this is not what Hagar wants to hear. That word submit is not yield yourself. It is a word in Hebrew that means you are going to be under the hand of your mistress. Under the hand means it's going to be a place of affliction. So God is sending her back to a difficult place, and he warns her that it's difficult. But there's something to be learned for us in here. The paths to God's promises are not paved with ease and comfort, and oh, how we wish they were. Oswald Chambers, in his book My Utmost for His Highest, says, an average view of the Christian life is that it means deliverance from trouble. It is deliverance in trouble, which is very different. If you are a child of God, there certainly will be troubles to meet. But Jesus says, do not be surprised when they come. In the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. There is nothing for you to fear. Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Well, when you get to teach like I'm teaching this morning and you don't teach all the time up front, you get to have a choice of what you're going to choose to pick to teach. And so when I was asked to preach, I got to choose what it was I was going to relate to you this morning. And I want to tell you the reason I picked this story is because a Bible study teacher a long time ago in my mid-30s had pointed me to this story because she said, your story sounds like the story of Hagar. And I wonder if you go back and you see the story of Hagar, if the name she gives God won't be an encouragement to you. So that's how I set off on this journey to discover the story of this woman who is tremendously overlooked in Scripture. Her story, her whole chapter, is usually lost in the story of the greater faith story of Abraham and Sarah. So I went back and I looked up Hagar, and I'll be darned if her story doesn't have some similarities. So I'll tell you a little bit of my journey. When I, women have heard this at retreat, so sorry, ladies, but the men are going to get to hear it this morning, I guess. When I was 15, my mother became ill, and she was my only parent. I didn't have any brothers and sisters, and I didn't have any relatives. I'd been cut off from them. They lived in North Carolina, and we lived in California. I grew up in California. And so when she became ill and was so ill that she was going to die, it was obviously terrifying for me. So during that period of time when she was hospitalized and sick, I was staying with some friends of hers that were strangers to me. And I would cry out at night. I would just cry for myself. And I was crying. I didn't know who God was at all. I was crying and saying, God, why me? Help. I need some help. I don't know what to do. Who's going to take care of me? Really that kind of crying at night. And I really had never heard a word about God in my life at home that I can recall, except I went at Easter and Christmas to church occasionally with my mom. But prayer was very beyond me. I was just crying out of desperation. Well, when I was driving home from the hospital one day, God spoke to me. And I used to never tell anybody that because I thought nobody will believe me. They'll think I'm making a hallucination up, or it was a mirage, sort of like Hagar in the desert. But I was encouraged by Hagar's story that God does work in this way, and so I wanted to tell you what he did. So God said to me in this voice, this kind of inner still voice inside me, I didn't see anything. He didn't have a voice that came down from heaven like he talks to Hagar. This was just in my spirit, and in my spirit there was a sense of calm and peace that came over me out of the blue from nowhere. And I recognized it as Jesus, and I don't know why I recognized it as Jesus, because God didn't say his Jesus. I'll tell you what the message was. I am God, your mother's time is finished, and I have a plan for your life. Now that wasn't exactly all I wanted to hear. I really would much have preferred him not saying that your mother's time is finished. But it came with such a sense of love and compassion and kindness in my spirit that it was good news to me somehow. It just came off as, wow, there's God. That means I'm not all alone. That means somebody's paying attention. That means somebody is bigger than me, knows what's going on with me. And I guess the assumption in my mind was that was good enough, because it was good enough for me at the time. I went on to not really understand. God never told me what the plan was. I lived with some guardians for a few years, and it was a good, safe place for me to be. And they took care of me, and I grew up. But it was a very, very hard place for me to be also. I lost everything that I ever had. I had nothing at all that was mine anymore. And those years were probably the harshest of my life. But as I've gotten older and looked back on it, I've realized that the places that are the hardest are often the places where God will work the most. And that seems to be what happened to me, because I've never lost my sense of God since then. But it took me 15 years to actually walk a Christian life. God was that patient with me. So God takes a long time sometimes when he reveals himself and he keeps wooing you and you keep going off in your own direction. And if you've experienced that, you know what I'm talking about. But God can bring you home if you'll only open your heart to him. So what my message really is in summary is God still speaks, God still hears, and God still acts. But for everyone, it's in very different ways. You're sitting here this morning in church. He may be speaking to you through a song. He may be speaking to you through part of my story. He may be speaking through you from a person that you're going to meet. But God is always actively alive and teaching and trying to draw us to him. So next week, we're going to hear about how a woman 2,000 years ago was coming to a well in Samaria in John 4, and Jesus meets her there, and it's a total surprise to her, and he totally changes her life. Well, after God met me, I don't exactly know what all of the plan is, but I did have a life that went on, and I got married and had some kids, and I've had a lot of fun wakeboarding and watching them jump. And we've had a really, there are always blessings within everybody's life if you can look for them. There are always something that God is doing in every life, even during those really harsh times with me. This life sounds so much better. But even during those harsh times, there was always things that encouraged me, people who were kind, or songs that I could sing that met my soul. And so I was nurtured, even in a hard place. So what God did for me, he did for Hagar, and God did for the woman at the well. So let's see what else more technically that God does for Hagar. He goes to her and he gives her a promise. And he says to her, I'll greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count. That's very much like the promise that he gave Abraham, who is going to be a father of the stars in the skies. That's quite a promise. And then he gives her his presence and a prophecy. He says to her that you're going to have a son, which she already knows she's going to have a child, but she doesn't know it's a son. You're going to have a son, and I want you to name him Ishmael, because I have heard of your affliction. Well, the name Ishmael means God hears. So what does it mean that God would name a child like this, God hears? Well, it means everything if you think about it, because every time Hagar called to him, she would hear, God hears, when she called his name. God hears, God hears. It's a constant reminder. There's a song that I thought of when I was writing this that I want to share you the words to the song. We're going to sing it later. But I think this is what it means. If God hears you and he sees you, it means he knows you. So this song's called He Knows My Name. I have a maker, and he formed my heart. Before even time began, my life was in his hand. He knows my name. He knows my every thought. He sees each tear that falls and hears me when I call. He hears me when I call. I have a father. He calls me his own. He'll never leave me no matter where I go. Now, I know this to be true. And so did Hagar, because she goes back to Abraham and Sarah. The rest of her story is in Genesis 21, and you'll find out that she goes back into the wilderness, and it's a really desperate time for them again. And Ishmael cries out, and God hears and delivers them. And in chapter 25 of Genesis, the promise to Ishmael comes true. He's the father of many nations. Now, most people will look at this and go, and I'll just have an aside since I have a little bit of the time to do it. Oh my goodness, it doesn't sound like a very good promise. It sounds like he's going to be hostile and violent and a wild donkey of a man, and I don't like that promise. Well, but the narrator of the story likes the promise, and Hagar liked the promise. Why? Because she's a slave, and what God has given her is a son who will be untamed and free. That is a desire of her heart. That is a beautiful desire of her heart. He'll always be free. Now, his character, God describes, he's going to be hostile and difficult, not get along with his brothers, and that also came to be. But God's promises for me and you are not the same. So you can't look at somebody else's experience and say, that's not fair. Because if God is present and if God is in it with you, then it's not about fair. It's about God meeting your need in that situation and getting you through that situation. And all of us have got different situations in our lives, or we will have at some point. So anyway, that's what really happens to Ishmael. He isn't the easiest son to raise. I bet you his teenage years were awful. I bet he was a really hard kid to raise. I bet he was hard to be around, but he was free. Okay, so, but the future promise, when I first saw this passage, I thought, I wonder if that's all she cares about, is that her son prospers. But after I studied this, it isn't at all the case with Hagar. The future promise is not what impresses Hagar about the encounter with God at all. She gets the hope of going home through that, but she focuses on the fact that she has an encounter with God, and I can see that in Genesis 16, 13, and 14. Because her response to the visitation is this. She called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, El Roy, which means you are a God who sees. For she said, have I even remained alive here after seeing him? And therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. Now, the wonder of knowing God personally is amazing to Hagar. You can almost feel her emotion as she names God this. You are a God who sees. You are a God who understands. That he would know her personally and call her by name and have her a plan for her life was just too wonderful for Hagar. He really sees her, and he gets her, and he sees her hurts and her needs and who she is as a person. She names the well as a moment of worship. So where God meets you, become your holy places. She names the well for what it means to her to have known this one, the well of the living one who sees me. So he sees her and he takes care of her. And there's an obscure verse, that one that's kind of hard to understand. Have I even remained alive here after seeing him? I'll try to explain it to you. There was a thought that if you saw God, you would die because he was too holy and you were too evil. That's one interpretation. But a closer definition and interpretation of what it really says in the Hebrew, it's kind of an obscure verse, NIV does a better job with, which is your study Bibles in your pews. Have I now seen the one who sees me? What's amazing to Hagar is that she not only was seen by God, but that he would give her the opportunity to see him as well. And isn't that what we want? We want to see God. We come to church on Sunday morning and said, let me see you, God. I need more of you. I need to taste more of you. This is where Hagar's heart is. God has seen her and she has seen him. This is the only time in Scripture where a human being gives a name to God. And it reflects a very personal relationship that she has with him. And this is Hagar's legacy of grace to us in her life, is if God would meet Hagar in that hard place of hers, he'll meet you and I in our hard desert places too. He'll meet you when your child is sick. He'll meet you when your husband's ill. He'll meet you when you lose your job. He'll meet you when your plans are dashed and when your relationship falls apart. These are all natural things that happen to each one of us in life. But Hagar is given his name. She said he's the God who sees. So we can take a hold of that and have that promise. Because that is so powerful to her, she goes home and she returns to that hard place we read. And it says, Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. So that's the end of the Hagar story in chapter 16. It has a good ending. I hope you can see it's a good ending because God's in it with her. And I wanted to give you a little time to respond to it, so I have some application questions that are going to go up on the screen behind me, or they're in your folder on a little green piece of paper. I'd like to leave you with a short time of reflection for you to consider if any of these questions are the place that God would want to meet you this morning. If not, then you have a couple of minutes to just be quiet and to fan yourself from all the heat and just relax. So, thank you.